Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Hi there, and welcome again to the Explaining History podcast. And today I'm going to talk a little bit about Britain's reaction to the invasion of the Soviet Union by Nazi Germany. I'm reading today from All Behind You, Winston, Churchill's Great Coalition 1940-45 by Roger Hermiston. And here we have the period of Barbarossa beginning on the 22nd of June 1941. Hermiston writes, "At 7:30 on the morning of Sunday the 22nd of June 1941, there was a knock on the door of Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden's room at Chequers. Churchill's valet Frank Sawyers entered and presented Eden with a large cigar and a silver salver, announced the Prime Minister's compliments and the German armies have invaded Russia. Putting on his dressing gown, Eden walked along the corridor to Churchill's room. We savoured the relief, but not for me at that hour, the cigar, and discussed what was immediately to do. After almost a year of isolation, Britain and the British Empire were no longer alone in facing the might of Hitler's forces." So, to describe it as isolation is perhaps not quite entirely the full story, because of course Britain was being armed and supplied by a entirely sympathetic United States of America, which was close to an undeclared shooting war in the Atlantic with Nazi Germany itself, between American destroyers and German U-boats. And also, the British Empire itself was such a huge resource of manpower and resources that it was more than able to absorb much of the challenges that Nazi Germany threw at it. However, what the British and what Churchill particularly was under no illusion about was the enormity of what Hitler had decided to undertake in an invasion of the Soviet Union. And the belief in Churchill's mind was not necessarily that the war had been won outright, but that Hitler had made the most enormous strategic blunder and had presented himself with a war that was virtually unwinnable. And it must have been in Churchill's thinking as well that potentially the two sides, the Soviet Union and Nazi Germany, would destroy one another. The invasion was of no surprise to either Eden or Churchill. The way that Eden recounts this story is not one of leaping out of bed in surprise, but of a thing occurring that had long been predicted and long been waited for. A week earlier, Churchill had warned Roosevelt, From every source at my disposal, including some most trustworthy, it looks as if a vast German onslaught on Russia was imminent. In theory, it should have been no surprise to Stalin either. Stalin had predicted a war, an attack, an invasion from Germany since the late 1920s. And yet, when it arrives, Stalin is in disbelief, partly because Stalin had convinced himself that he had taken the necessary precautions to keep relations stable between Germany and the Soviet Union. Intelligence flowing from his top spy in Tokyo, Richard Sorge, who had access to diplomatic traffic from Berlin, and also from intelligence from Great Britain, from the Signals Intelligence Centre at Bletchley Park, where the Soviet spy George Cairncross had been selecting valuable information about German intentions towards the USSR and then passing it on to his Soviet handlers, had presented Stalin with knowledge that an invasion was a near certainty at some point in mid to late June. However, Stalin had been very reluctant to face such facts, and indeed Stalin has a complete nervous breakdown once the inevitability of German invasion is realised to him, once the invasion has actually begun. He was convinced that what he was hearing was Western disinformation designed to lure him into a preemptive war against Nazi Germany and then create the kind of clash between the two regimes on the Eastern Front that would destroy both of them. Churchill had predicted down to a window of a week or so when the invasion might begin. And as such, he had invited that particular weekend the United States Ambassador John Winant and his Churchill's own personal friend, the Secretary of State for Dominion Affairs, Lord Cranborne. The initial satisfaction that the Americans and the British had at hearing the news then gave way to some reservations. Winant suspects it may all be a put-up job between Hitler and Stalin, observed the close Churchill confidant, Jock Colville. That comment is very revealing. It shows the degree of mistrust between the British and Americans on one side and the Soviets on the other. The Soviets, who had, for the previous 2 years, been part of a non-aggression and cooperation agreement with Nazi Germany, and it was reasonably well known that the Soviets had extended to Nazi Germany all sorts of assistance in terms of intelligence, submarine bases, and a flow of cheap resources from the Soviet Union to Nazi Germany. At Chirkley Court on the same day, the home of Lord Beaverbrook, the Churchill's Minister of Aircraft Production and the owner of the Daily Express, Michael Foot, who was one of the later, obviously, leader of the Labour Party and one of Britain's kind of foremost democratic socialists, Michael Foot, who was a journalist for the Express, wrote and had written previously the polemic Guilty Men, which had criticised Chamberlain and an entire generation of appeasers. He supposedly ran downstairs and found a copy of in the gramophone cupboard of the Internationale, and began to play it on the gramophone, waking up the entire household, including Beaverbrook's butlers and his staff. And he wrote in his diaries, I was happy to inform the bleary-eyed household, guests and butlers alike, that we were now allies of the Soviet Union. It was Obviously, at this point, no formal agreement has been reached between Britain and the Soviet Union, but it was an almost fait accompli. It was almost a given that this would occur. Eden got up immediately from Chequers to go to London to meet Ivan Majsky, who was the Soviet ambassador to London. Majsky's a fascinating character, and the Majsky diaries are well worth a read. At that point, the rest of the War Cabinet, including Beaverbrook and Sir Stafford Cripps, later Labour Chancellor, and somebody who Churchill passionately loathed, were invited to Chequers in order to discuss and debate the events of that day. Cripps had a slightly darker view of things than perhaps Churchill did. Cripps had argued previously that the Russians would not be able to hold out against Germany for more than a few weeks. And the nightmare scenario for the British would be that Germany actually succeeded in the Soviet Union. If Germany managed to win in the Soviet Union, then the Germans would have access to virtually limitless resources in which to wage a renewed war in the West. So the interesting thing for this discussion, I guess, is that that Saturday, Churchill also concurred that Russia would more than certainly be defeated by the Germans. However, it was the elation of finding an ally. It was the elation of not being alone any longer that seemed to really matter to Churchill. This was an emotional moment. If you leave aside for the moment that this new potential ally was a regime that was feared and hated by Churchill, that Churchill himself, during the Russian Civil War, had attempted to overthrow, and the fact that it could potentially wind up presenting Germany with a conquest that would give Germany global ambitions and global power. Those things aside, Churchill still believed that there was opportunity in this moment, and that perhaps there was something here that would also make it more likely that the Americans would then join the war. Churchill drafted a speech for broadcast for that night that would offer unequivocal support for the Soviet Union, and it would have greater strength coming from Churchill himself. Hermiston writes, "Such was the care and attention given to the drafting that it was finished only 20 minutes before Churchill was due to go on air. When it was delivered, he made it clear that he would unsay no word of criticism that he had levelled against the Soviet regime over the past quarter of a century. But he then went on to lend his support with some of the most vivid folksy imagery he had used in any of his wartime speeches. I see Russian soldiers standing on the threshold of their native land, guarding the fields which their fathers had tilled from time immemorial. I see them guarding their homes where their mothers and wives pray. Ah yes, for there are times when all pray, for the safety of their loved ones, for the return of the breadwinner, of the champion, of their protector. I see 10,000 villages of Russia, where the means of existence was wrung so hardly from the soil, but where there are still primordial human joys, where maidens laugh and children play. Advancing upon this bucolic bliss was the Nazi war machine, with its clanking, heel-clicking, dandified Prussian officers, its crafty expert agents, fresh from the cowing and tying of a dozen countries. Churchill's conclusion was that any man or state who fights on against Nazism will have our aid. It follows, therefore, that we shall give whatever help we can to Russia and the Russian."
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, "What the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?" So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com. With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
People. The question of what help the British could realistically give the Russians was an interesting one. The main help to Russia comes in the form of American trucks and aircraft, but mainly vehicles to move armies around that come when America enters the war. The British send some aircraft, they send Hurricanes to Murmansk, and the Arctic convoys that resupply the northern Cape and the Arctic of Russia have to go around the top of Norway to reach the Arctic ports. Those sail from Britain, but often they are full of American raw materials. So there is some question over how useful British aid was and how extensive British aid was to the Soviet Union. But also, the thing that the Soviets want almost immediately, that there's an agreement between Britain and the Soviet Union, is a second front in Europe. From early 1942 onwards, they're agitating for this and nothing else. Stalin looked upon Britain's air war over Germany, and later America's air war over Germany, and the second front that emerges in Italy with barely concealed disdain and disgust, thinking that only an Allied invasion of France was going to be anywhere near what was required. The ability that the Soviets had to sacrifice manpower to pour division after division into battles made Stalin look upon the West as being positively squeamish about casualties. The most vocal ally of the Soviet Union would turn out to be Lord Beaverbrook, as previously said, proprietor of the Daily Express and close friend of Churchill. Churchill himself, whilst he presented a speech that offered any help possible to the Soviet Union, was still very, very wary of Stalin and had a deep-seated aversion to the Soviet regime. The knowledge that Britain had gone to war to guarantee the defence of Poland and the independence of Poland, and that one of the Poland's chief persecutors and aggressors was the Soviet Union itself, was not lost on Churchill or the War Cabinet. Men like Eden and Lord Cranborne were very cagey about what was said about the Soviet Union, and that the words of support should only be placed within a kind of a military context. The idea that the Soviet Union was any better than Nazi Germany politically was objectionable. And there would be widespread dissent, widespread dislike of any policy of official sympathy towards the Soviet Union. Well, all the evidence suggests that actually attitudes towards Nazi Germany and Great Britain during the 1930s, at least, were far, far more hard line, far more anti-Nazi than they were anti-Soviet. Not to suggest that there was widespread support for the Soviet Union, but there was significantly less condemnation of the Soviet Union and significantly more willingness to see the Soviet Union. However misguided this view is, as a progressive force in history. And one only needs to look at the flow of British intellectuals to the Soviet Union during the five-year plans to observe all of the changes happening there, and to get a flavour of the kind of the intellectual climate of the time. So probably there wouldn't have been 50% of the country up in arms about friendly words towards the Soviet Union. Churchill was also concerned about the stance of the Labour Party in the cabinet, and he believed that any speeches that they made should continue to draw a line of demarcation between the tenets of the Labour Party and those of communism. Well, that again shows Churchill's lack of understanding of the internal politics of the Labour Party that had been condemnatory of the Communist Party of Great Britain since its inception. The Labour Party during the 1930s had rejected the hunger marches as they had been organised by the National Unemployed Workers Movement, which again was a creation of the Communist Party of Great Britain. So he needn't have worried that the Labour Party were in any way sympathetic towards communist thinking. Attlee reminds Churchill not to worry, and that he was promising to emphasise the differences between Labour, Labour's moderate brand of socialism and Soviet communism in a BBC broadcast to go out on the Sunday evening, on the 23rd. Reassurances came also from Herbert Morrison, the Minister for Economic Warfare, who said that despite the changes in circumstances, that there was no reason to lift the ban on any kind of communist publications, that the Communist Party would not get a voice, and particularly banned publications like the Daily Worker would not, during the war years, come back into circulation. However, there would be gradually over time, and some of this comes from the Ministry of Information, a change in the view that many British media outlets had towards the Soviet Union, from a brutal regime of labour camps to one of a kind of a stoic people who were resisting with courage and valour the predations of Nazi Germany. And you also see a version of this in kind of American official war information towards the Soviet Union, and the creation of the idea of there being Stalin as Uncle Joe. To give you an idea of some of the kind of absurdity that seeped into the official ways in which the Soviet Union could and could not be thought about, there is an example of the broadcast of a popular programme known as National Anthems of the Allies. This went out every Sunday evening at 9 o'clock. And a new song of a new ally now had to be added to the list, and of course that was the Internationale. This was the anthem of the working class worldwide, and was the rallying call of communists and socialists the world over. And this was met with immense dislike by the arch-elitist Winston Churchill. On the Thursday, the 10th of July, the song and the question of broadcasting the song came on the agenda of the War Cabinet. Anthony Eden and the Minister of Information, Alfred Duff Cooper, were told to speak directly to the BBC and ask them to play Tchaikovsky's 1812 Overture instead, which was obviously dedicated to the famous Russian Field Marshal Kutuzov, who had fought back and resisted the Grand Army at the Battle of Borodino. Napoleon's Grand Army, that is. So it was designed to be used instead of the Internationale. It had an entirely different political meaning, an entirely different political, ideological, and historical context. The BBC obliged with this, and 3 days later, the Soviet national anthem vanished from the airways. The result was not kind of nodding approval from the Daily Express, but a degree of scorn. The Daily Express noted, and this is the Daily Express, the property of Lord Beaverbrook, who had, you know, become this arch propagandist and spokesman for all things Soviet. Referred to the broadcast as poor, overlain with surging and fading normal to shortwave broadcasts. Cassandra in the Daily Mirror, the columnist Cassandra in the Daily Mirror, under the heading Age of Kant, said that the Foreign Office's skirmishes over playing the International were one of the most amusing and ludicrous farces we have had for some time. As the British public solidarity with the Russian people deepened during the life and death struggle that unfolded over the following months, so did the clamour for the International to return, which it did 6 months later. There are certain things governments do periodically which, at a kind of a cabinet meeting level, seem like a good idea, and yet when they are rolled out as public policy, can appear petty, absurd, small-minded, and ridiculous. And this was one of them, a fairly trivial matter, but one which seemed to kind of almost insult the intelligence of the general public. And this was perhaps why there was such kind of widespread derision and condemnation of this action. So throughout the war, the British public, the British government, and Churchill himself would have to encounter their very complicated and contradictory and often bruising relationship with the Soviet Union, a regime that, unlike the British, started off from a moment of true devastation and fought back from the brink. A regime that faces, actually experiences invasion and catastrophe on an almost unprecedented scale. And it is a regime that Churchill never trusts and never likes, but is forced to both trust and tolerate. And Churchill himself has several encounters with Stalin, and the relationship between the two men evolves throughout the war until finally Stalin has entirely the upper hand. But more on that as we get to it. Anyway, I hope you found this useful, and I'll catch you later on the next Explaining History podcast. All the best. Bye-bye.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.